Hello, you're listening to The Northern Agenda, the podcast that takes you outside the Westminster bubble and digs into the big political issues affecting the north of England. I'm Rob Parsons, a political journalist based in Leeds. Every day I scour our region to find out what our mayors, councils and MPs are up to and report it in an email newsletter called The Northern Agenda. You can hear some of those stories in a bit more detail on this weekly podcast. This week, I want to tell you about a really great new exhibition telling the story of the trailblazing contributions of Muslims living and working in the north of England. It's based in Leeds and it's called Muslims of the North. I've been speaking to Maria Hussein, one of the people behind the display, who's explaining why it contributes to the cultural diversity of northern England and telling me about three of the trailblazing Muslims in the north who feature in it.
There is a bit of a gap in terms of framing the contemporary kind of experience of Muslims at the moment and really making it tangible and clear kind of what people are doing in those particular sectors. So in relation to kind of law, research, healthcare and commerce as well. So kind of moving beyond, you know, kind of the narrative of, you know, the corner shop, for example, which is, you know, a really strong stereotype.
So have a listen to that interview later. First, though, I think we should have a look at some of the big politics stories of the week, where it feels like everything happening at Westminster now has to be seen in the context of the upcoming general election. We don't know when it's going to be. There seems to be a growing school of thought that says Rishi Sunak could even call a snap election in early May, but maybe it won't be till the back end of the year. Debate's still raging about that one. But let's talk about what it all means for the North with Henry Muirson, Chief Executive of the Northern Powerhouse Partnership. Henry, welcome.
Thanks, Rob. Great to be back.
Very nice to have you on, as always. So as this podcast goes out, the Prime Minister and Chancellor Jeremy Hunt are going to be in the northeast of England talking about the big trailblazer devolution deal for that part of the world, and particularly the steps that are enabling the creation of a game-changing film studio in Sunderland that could create thousands of jobs. And I imagine they will be asked while they're there about, you know, what is the government doing for the north of England, for places like Sunderland? And there's a quite timely report, which is out this week, about the sort of the legacy, I guess, of Levelling Up, which obviously is something that, you know, Boris Johnson, he coined that phrase, he started that agenda. But 5 years down the line from the last general election, there's a new report by the Public Accounts Committee, which says the government is unable to provide any compelling examples of what Levelling Up funding has delivered so far. And it says that councils have been able to spend just a fraction, 10% of the government's promised Levelling Up funding to reduce inequality. 10.47 billion is a total funding that's been allocated, but only a billion of that has actually been spent by hard-pressed local councils. So I guess in the run-up to the election, whenever that's going to be, people are going to be asking, has Levelling Up actually happened? And perhaps this report tells us that maybe it hasn't. I mean, what's your take on it, Henry?
So the simple answer is, Rob, unfortunately, this was all very predictable. So asking councils to spend huge sums of public money, bidding for money, and then having to spend even longer periods waiting around while government read them all, and then without any proper criteria, throwing the money out the door, has led to, combined with construction inflation in the meantime, a series of undeliverable projects which were had to be come up with in such a short period, and actually now will cost more than they were originally anticipated, hasn't been the best way of spending these funds. And it's why we had devolution in the first place. So we created combined authorities like the one in the northeast that's now there, but it was preceded by one on the north bank of the river, Greater Manchester, West Yorkshire, the Liverpool City region, South Yorkshire. All these mayors had funding deals with government long before the Levelling Up Fund was come up with. And so why on earth were they not given this money to spend on projects within their combined authorities? And for those councils that don't have a combined authority, why not just give them an allocation? The need to bid for this money made the process so much more complicated. And areas like County Durham, for example, bid for money and then didn't receive much of it, even in the third round. And so you could argue that actually much of the money spent designing these projects was wasted.
Yeah, I mean, there have been a few pretty extraordinary sort of failures in the way this whole system operates. And you mentioned County Durham. I think they put in a whole load of bids in the second round of the Levelling Up Fund, not realising that, because they hadn't been told, that if they had been successful in the first round, they had no chance of being successful in the second round. And lots of councils put in bids for big regeneration projects that were doomed to failure because of rules that they were unaware of. And this report, it's interesting because it says that more impactful bids for funding lost out due to optimism bias in favour of so-called shovel-ready projects. So the government tried to give money to projects that in theory were ready to go more quickly, giving them priority over projects that might have had more of an impact. But that didn't take into account the difficulties that we hear so much about with local councils, that, you know, they don't have the resource now as much as they used to actually deliver these projects. And with construction inflation and this general local authorities being low on resource, that is a large part of the reason why this hasn't happened, isn't it?
Exactly, Rob. And I mean, people may remember as well that some councils actually received money towards their bids for round two, even though it was then decided before the bids had even been properly assessed that those same councils wouldn't receive any money. So the kind of the approach that government took, I think, didn't make a lot of sense. And I do think there are questions for the Prime Minister to answer while he's in the North East today, because he was the Chancellor who oversaw this. If you remember, he was very happy to tour the country as well to announce some of these bids when he just became Prime Minister in round two. And he has got to take some responsibility for the way this system has worked, because we have so little money allocated to economic development in the regions of this country. To waste a single penny of it is absolutely just unacceptable. And I'm really depressed, really, to be honest, about how this has all turned out. Local government is often so disempowered by central government. You have huge gaps in their revenue budget. And then for them to be encouraged to spend money developing schemes, many of which will never happen, wasting funds that could have been used to put towards vital local services. It's a terrible, terrible kind of allegorical tale for the wider woes of the relationship between the local state and the national state of this country, which is you have a disempowered local state that doesn't have anywhere near the resources to do what it needs to do, and sort of taking part in a beauty pageant is as degrading for local government as many feminists would argue it is for women.
Yeah, it's a sad state of affairs, absolutely. Well, on a related note, so the Prime Minister, under whom the whole Levelling Up Fund and the various funds that local areas had to bid for was created, Boris Johnson, I read that there are talks between him and, you know, senior Conservatives about getting him back on the campaign trail in the so-called Red Wall, these former Labour areas that went Conservative in 2019, to try and win voters back ahead of the general election. Obviously, we know Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson still don't get on well with each other. It's unclear whether they've actually spoken to each other or not about this, or whether they're on speaking terms at all. But I mean, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Whether Boris Johnson's appeal would continue in the north of England after everything that's happened, the pandemic, the cost of living crisis, Partygate, all the water that's gone under the bridge since 2019. I mean, do you think he could be an effective campaigner in these Red Wall seats whenever the election is, or is the Conservative Party too far gone for that?
I mean, I don't think you can deny that Boris Johnson clearly was able to connect with communities across the North and the Midlands in a way that very few Conservatives before or likely since will ever manage. And I'm still struck by his visit to a market in Doncaster on the way to the Convention of the North in Rotherham. And Rob, you and I and some of your fellow colleagues and journalists were sat in the press room, I know, watching the news coverage as he was coming to us. And the pictures of him being sort of mobbed positively, not negatively, with Jake Berry at his side wearing his distinctive Northern Powerhouse Minister issue flat cap at the time. I mean, I still remember it like it was yesterday, and it sort of showed what was likely to happen in the election long before I think many commentators really realised the scale of what was about to happen. I think the challenge is that Boris Johnson's brand is not what it was then, and clearly the Conservative Party is way behind in the polls. And I think that's the challenge, is that the coalition he put together was based on delivering genuine kind of and well-meant kind of promises to the people of the north of England, in particular, that he would make real things happen. Well, I mean, there's no way of arguing that that levelling up and economic disparities are central to the government's programme currently. And so the challenge is, I know Andrea Jenkins was saying to the Today programme yesterday how much she'd love Boris to come back, and she's not a fan of the Prime Minister. I'm sure she might prefer that Prime Minister of old to come and campaign for rather than the current one. But whether he's really going to be able to sell a product that isn't actually the product he promised 5 years ago, and that is the issue when you have three Prime Ministers selling the same manifesto, is that each time there's been a change in Prime Minister, the agenda has moved on. But the promises that were made 5 years ago that this Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, is going to be held accountable for are the ones that was in his manifesto then. And I think whether it's in the high street in Morley or back in Doncaster, even those MPs that are the biggest fans of Boris, I think might be hoping for a miracle that's never going to come, which is that he isn't the Prime Minister anymore. The agenda that the government is pursuing is not the one he sold their voters in many cases. And so is he really going to be able to connect? And I think that kind of, I remember that Teesside homemade sign, probably as iconic in Northeast political history as the ones at Tony Blair's leaving event that I was at when I was in a different job at a different time in my life. And those are political moments that come around every 10, 15, 20 years, nationally, never mind in the north of England. I'm just not sure that this is going to be the Back for Good remake that Take That's reunion tours were, Rob. So it may have worked for Gary Barlow and co, but I'm not sure it's going to work for the Conservative Party.
You sound like a man who's got tickets to the Take That reunion tour.
I mean, my only commitment is to the people and the businesses in the north of England. My own personal musical tastes have to take second fiddle, Rob, to the day job, I'm afraid.
Quite right too. Let's talk about buses, which, you know, a big passion, we're led to believe, of Boris Johnson's. And one of the things that he wanted to do was to help bring about a London-style transport system outside London in all the different areas of the north. And this week in West Yorkshire, we moved one crucial step closer to achieving that, or at least hopefully we have. Tracy Brabin has become the third Metro Mayor in Northern England to approve the idea of bus franchising, i.e. taking local bus services out of private hands and into public control. Decisions on routes and fares will now be made by her combined authority, and not bus companies like First and Arriva. I saw this week that Arriva in West Yorkshire was named the worst bus company in the country on customer satisfaction, which is quite a state of affairs. I mean, I guess the thing about bus franchising is that it, as has been proved the case in Greater Manchester, it takes a long time to come into force. You know, there's quite a lot of legal opposition to it in Greater Manchester. And even when it happens, there's quite a lot of teething problems. It's not a silver bullet that is going to solve the many woes of the bus system straight away, is it?
I mean, it's not the only solution, because you also need a reliable revenue support system, which we don't currently have for bus services in this country. So you need a sustainable source of income to subsidise those routes that are kind of socially necessary but are never going to be profitable, but are essential for people to get to hospital, to get from poorer communities to areas of well-paid employment. Do you mean that is vital for our country? I think back to the original devolution deal, where famously I think a former leader of Manchester City Council, Richard Leese, said that they only accepted the mayor because it came with the bus powers. And It is incredibly important that local government gets back the ability to drive the connectivity, particularly for those residents who don't have access to a car, and many of those who would like to choose not to have a car. I mean, it's in terms of sustainable transport, it's absolutely vital for access to employment. It's absolutely vital. So I think James Lewis was excited on the bus this morning from Kippax, where he lives, on one of those now famous Arriva buses, for those readers of your daily newsletter, Rob, who could see that on your diagram, it was at the very, very rock bottom of the league table. But I don't think that I would argue bus franchise is a solution to every problem. But if you want to create a more productive north of England, then enabling people to get around between the towns and cities of West Yorkshire is critical. If you want to increase the ability to grow the economies of both Leeds and Bradford as two significant cities alongside Wakefield, you've got to absolutely allow people to get around by bus. And at the moment, in too many of the towns and even the relatively built-up areas of those cities, the bus service is just woeful. And that is an economic drag that we could do without. And it is one of the things that differentiates, as well as mass transit, Greater London from a region like West Yorkshire. Greater London has both the tube network and a good bus system. West Yorkshire has neither.
Well, indeed. Although it should be pointed out that we are closer, perhaps, than we've ever been to getting a mass transit system in West Yorkshire. The government is actually putting up some money, £2.5 billion, to make it happen. I think there's a route that's been announced between Leeds and Bradford, although I think the first trams on this route won't be running until the mid-2030s. So we've still got a way to go before we are able to travel seamlessly on the tram between Leeds and Bradford. But it's a start. I guess when you start from such a low base, you've got to take these wins as you get them. The last thing I was going to ask you about, Henry, an interesting report by the IPPR North think tank about parish councils, which obviously are the councils covering, you know, villages and town areas below a lower level to, you know, local authorities. We often talk about they have responsibility for things like local fireworks displays often, and maintaining the sort of street scenery in their local areas. But 60% of parish council seats go uncontested, so no one is actually contesting the elections to be a parish councillor in 60% of these seats. And IPPR North's solution to this problem is to allow 16 and 17 year olds, who obviously at the moment can't vote, to be able to vote in parish council elections, so which will have the effect of making the councils themselves a bit more relevant, but also broadening local democracy. It's quite an interesting idea, I think, isn't it? What do you make of it?
I mean, from when I was first involved in politics, and in I was also a trustee of the British Youth Council before I was a student when I was at uni, I've always been a great supporter of votes at 16 anyway. And I think the time has come for that. I'm always enjoy reading the work of our friends at IPPR North, and I'll certainly be looking forward to celebrating their 20th birthday with them next week, which is an anniversary that I know the team there are really looking forward to. But I think I would say, as a former town councillor, as well as in my dim and distant past, being involved in a sort of a metropolitan borough up in the northeast, I do see the important role of kind of that most local level of democracy. And anyone who can remember the sort of the David Miliband heyday of kind of double devolution and the idea of empowering local government, but local government also empowering directly communities, whether that be kind of local community groups or parish and town councils. I think there's real value to that movement. And I think that it's very easy to say that kind of democratic renewal can only be achieved by sorting out Westminster politics. I genuinely do believe, as IPPR North I think do, that people engaging with local democracy is as important as kind of questions of representation at the national level. Because most of the things that people would want to change and care about happen at their very local level. Central government is absolutely important. It's what dominates the national news media for obvious reasons. But I do think even if it's not just for the light entertainment in your great daily newsletter, Rob, when you can read about the comings and goings over a sycamore tree in Teesside. This is what does really matter to people in their local areas. And that's why clearly we need to encourage people to get involved in their parish and town councils. But we also probably need to give them more money and control. As someone who's half French, I'm very familiar with the French system, where the mairie, even in a very small village, is a genuinely important political institution. It has significant power and authority. I don't see why this country doesn't trust the very local level of democracy to do more, because in the end, that is what will get people more involved. And certainly I know in North Yorkshire, alongside unitarisation, creating quite powerful town councils in places like Harrogate has been part of that initiative. And I think that is the right way to do this, that we don't need multiple layers of government delivering complex services. But what we do need is a tier of democracy that is locally accountable and can do genuinely local decision making, but is different from service delivery and managing what are things that are probably best left to larger scale of local government.
Henry Muirson, thank you so much. Now, in my home city of Leeds, there's a new museum display I think Northern Agenda listeners will be very interested in, celebrating the trailblazing contributions of Muslims living and working in the north of England. Leeds City Museum's Voices of Asia Gallery is hosting Muslims of the North, which explores the pioneering work of prominent Muslims in fields including commerce, healthcare, law, and research. I wanted to hear all about this. So let's talk to Maria Hussein, lecturer in management and organisations at the University of Leeds Business School, whose research underpins this whole display. Maria, welcome.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on the show. I'm really excited to be here.
Excellent. Well, why don't you just start by telling us a bit about your research and how it ended up forming the basis of this new exhibition?
Sure. As well as being a lecturer at the business school, I'm also a Leeds Institute for Teaching Excellence research fellow. So the research that I have done that's underpinning the exhibition Muslims in the North explores the perceived value of cultural diversity from kind of the university campus to the global workplace. We know that the world is becoming more and more interconnected, and so are our challenges as well, increasingly global. We also know that COVID has kind of shown us that a one-size-fits-all approach isn't really effective and it's not very equitable. So we do need diversity of thought to solve our complex, increasingly global problems and challenges. And also in terms of, I guess, addressing those challenges in relation to the UN SDG goals as well. So there is, there's also a really strong business case as well for cultural diversity and diversity of thought to be realised and to really, to be nurtured and harnessed. McKinsey did an international study in 2020, which looked at board level performance in relation to cultural and ethnic diversity. So diversity at the top table and kind of looking at kind of how those strategic kind of well-placed decision makers in large companies, what do they actually bring to the table in terms of performance? So they looked at large companies and they looked particularly at board level diversity. And what they found was quite interesting, that where you had a greater mix of cultural and ethnic diversity at the top, so at board level, those companies outperformed similar sized and shaped companies that had less diversity. So it does make good business sense as well. However, we do know that there's still, quite a bit of work to be done for this, to actually nurture different perspectives, different cultural ways of thinking and being, and for it to actually be valued as well. So within like the UK context specifically, there was a review that was done by McGregor in 2017 that actually, I guess, put a number on the untapped talent, let's say, of BAME or ethnic diverse talent that wasn't really being utilised fully. And that was, quite an astounding figure. It was £1 billion that was lost to the UK economy. So in terms of how this relates to the display itself, I really wanted to showcase, you know, what can happen, what magic can really happen when diversity of thought and talent is enabled, it's nurtured, and it's visible. And it's really also, you know, it also seeks to debunk lots of, you know, common stereotypes that often, you know, kind of deficit model different ways of being and thinking, which I think is, you know, it's a real, you know, it's a real lost opportunity. So I think, you know, by talking about and by making visible a lot of untold stories that you perhaps won't hear elsewhere, in a very contemporary and positive framing, I hope that, you know, it can lead to, you know, greater curiosity, lots more opportunity to have conversations like this today, to get people talking.
Yeah, absolutely. So I see that there's objects on display at the Leeds City Museum include an Islamic headscarf, necklace, and the 2022 Commonwealth Games mascot loaned by Nazir Afzal, who we'll hear a bit more about later. But I mean, do you think visitors to this exhibit will be surprised by what they find there? What are some of the sort of highlights that you think people might be most interested in?
Yeah, so that's quite a nice example. And Nazir Afzal, he kind of mentioned, and he, you know, I guess it's humanizing a lot of those stories. So he also loaned to us a nice picture of him when he was 8 years old. And he said that was the first kind of passport picture that he had taken. And also the Commonwealth baton mascot as well, because he was one of the torchbearers there. And he talked about kind of his journey, his family kind of coming to the UK, you know, with not very much. And then he talked in relation to kind of, I guess, contextualizing that. So from when he was eight, and then, you know, kind of being, you know, now he's a public figure, but at the time, you know, being given that honor of opening the Commonwealth Games, and just, you know, I guess, symbolizing his contribution, but, you know, placing that in the kind of UK context that, you know, this can really happen, but there is a lot of work to be done. And in terms of, I guess, some of the highlights or perhaps some of the surprising elements that, you know, visitors might have when they visit the exhibition, it's just, you know, some of the contributions, I guess, that you won't probably hear or learn about. So the fact that there are 29,000 Muslim doctors within the NHS, you know, that are working really hard for everyone. But again, it's not something that you'll hear about kind of in a positive way. And also in terms of kind of contribution to the UK economy. So £31 billion is contributed by kind of, you know, the Muslim community, which is, you know, a group of diverse communities, I'd like to say as well. So those are some of, I guess, some of the highlights. But I think overarching some of the overarching elements that might be surprising as well. So often when you think about, you might think about, you know, a Muslim might think about, well, you know, I know that they have to pray five times a day. It's now the holy month of Ramadan. So they'll, you know, they like to fast as well and charity. But what I also wanted to bring to life is some of the principles that guide Muslims in their daily lives to humanize, you know, the stories. So you'll also kind of notice within the exhibition, some of those Islamic principles being highlighted. So the fact that, you know, there's a huge emphasis on the pursuit of knowledge. So any type of beneficial knowledge, because we are expected to contribute, you know, in positive ways. And that could be, you know, through our, you know, talents. It could be through kind of economic ways of or contributing to society. But we are expected to, you know, make the world a better place for everyone. So this idea of pursuit of knowledge, ilm, and the pursuit of excellence as well. So the fact that you don't just kind of, you know, get things over the line, you should be aiming for excellence in everything and anything that you do. And, you know, also in relation to that, you know, kind of resilience, being patient, so having sabr, and always being grateful for whatever kind of life throws at you. So there are lots of things I think that many people will be able to take away, and hopefully it'll help to kind of humanize and really surface, you know, the diverse talents of I think a quite under perhaps lesser understood community within Leeds or within the North. So I think that's kind of what I hope people will be able to take away from it, that, you know, we do lots more than what you might think in terms of like the five pillars of Islam. And also just making it making it more tangible in terms of what those contributions might look like, you know, in terms of, you know, the NHS, the legal system. You know, we've got Nazir Afzal, who was in his chief crown prosecuting role for almost a quarter of a century. You know, that's a huge contribution to the justice system. And justice, like, you know, social justice is a huge tenet of, you know, the Islamic faith as well.
It's interesting you talk about perhaps the Muslim faith not being so well understood perhaps by other sections of the community. I mean, is one of the issues that you're trying to address with this display the fact that, I mean, maybe not just in the North, but nationally, yeah, often people aren't as tolerant or maybe as curious as they could be about other cultures, and that maybe not everyone appreciates the value of cultural diversity? Is this an attempt to sort of tackle that trend?
Yeah, and I think, you know, as I mentioned, in terms of the research that underpins this research dissemination activity, so sharing some of the key findings, is that we know that, you know, we need different ways of thinking to solve complex problems. A one way of thinking and doing isn't going to be able to enable us to get to where we need to be kind of, you know, in the immediate long-term kind of future, because the, you know, our challenges are increasingly complex and increasingly interconnected globally too. And in relation to, I guess, the exhibition itself, you know, I think the reason why, and again, kind of thinking about the interest that's been sparked at the moment, but when I had conversations with people in the initial stages, it was something that, you know, was of real interest, I think, because there is a bit of a gap in terms of framing the contemporary kind of experience of Muslims at the moment and really making it tangible and clear kind of what people are doing in those particular sectors. So in relation to kind of law, research, healthcare, and commerce as well. So kind of moving beyond, you know, kind of the narrative of, you know, the corner shop, for example, which is, you know, a really strong stereotype. And again, you know, kind of, I guess, humanizing some of the other conversations as well. And I think, you know, our civic spaces, so Leeds City Museum is an amazing venue. And I've learned so much, again, kind of going back more now as an adult, in terms of what, you know, what those spaces can mean, and in terms of, you know, how representative they are of the communities that they kind of serve. And I guess the real potential to open up the spaces in different ways that, you know, could be quite innovative, to invite more voices in, and to keep them alive, you know, with new and interesting ideas that represent, you know, the challenges of the day.
Yeah, because you, in the press release about the display, there's an interesting quote from you which says, I hope to contribute to work towards decolonizing civic spaces to become more inclusive and representative of our diverse communities. I'm interested in, you know, the decolonizing as a concept. So what, can you just explain a bit more what you mean by that?
Yeah, so I guess what I mean by that is, you know, if we look at our demographics, you know, today, for example, compared to, like, so, you know, our parents' generation, you know, you'll find there are quite, you know, there are lots of differences, and there's reasons for that. But I think in terms of actually celebrating the positive contribution by an increasingly diverse, you know, local population, national population, that's not something necessarily that we get to do very often, or that we'll perhaps, you know, see in the media, because it becomes, you know, quite a political vehicle for many reasons. So I think what I mean by that is to actually celebrate the diversity, to, you know, include everyone that is part of the city, part of the region, in those public spaces, which we know are increasingly under threat for you know, a number of reasons, especially I think in the North, where, you know, central funding isn't always equitable or equal. So I think, you know, there's a lot of value in that. I mean, we know that there's value in numbers, there's value in representation as well, I think. So I think more people that can get involved and see the real benefit and potential going forwards, you know, thinking about our next upcoming generation, Generation Z, who are increasingly, you know, kind of in the digital spaces. But I think, you know, kind of including everyone to take ownership of those really important and amazing places that have so much history and heritage for everyone to share is important to increase that, I think, and not to lose, you know, those spaces, which, you know, as I said, are becoming under threat with, you know, funding cuts becoming the norm, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, that's very much true. Now, you mentioned humanising sort of Muslims in the North, and so you've done a bit of homework. I asked you to pick out three trailblazing Muslims in the North, just as, I guess, an example of what we're talking about. Now, you've already mentioned Nazir Afzal, which I think is a name a lot of listeners might know, former chief Crown Prosecutor for the Northwest, in the media quite a lot as an expert on sort of criminal justice. I think he's the chancellor at one of the universities in Manchester.
Yeah, University of Manchester.
Yeah, absolutely. But a couple of the other trailblazers that you mentioned, one set of brothers who people might not necessarily know their names, but they'll certainly know the name of the company that they help run. Tell us about them.
Yeah, so Mohsin and Zubair Issa, MBE, are the joint owners of Asda, so the supermarket giant. And again, you know, they're billionaire brothers, as they're termed in the media. But, you know, they come from quite humble beginnings. They're both from the Northwest, Blackburn. And in terms of, you know, just looking at kind of their contribution to the UK in terms of the number of jobs, so around 150 jobs were created, you know, by their kind of enterprise. They also brought Asda back into UK ownership, which is, you know, a huge kind of injection to the economy. And then more locally, you know, Asda is headquartered in Leeds. So, you know, that kind of contribution, that positive framing and understanding that story itself, I don't think has been fully kind of harnessed in relation to kind of, you know, surfacing, you know, the diversity element and the contribution that different, you know, pockets of our, you know, diverse kind of community within Leeds and within kind of the broader northern region is not necessarily being kind of surfaced in that way in other places for the public to kind of digest and understand and appreciate. So I think that was quite interesting. And I guess just doing a bit of research, you know, into their kind of lives and things, it was quite interesting that, and Nazir is also based in the Northwest. So there's a little bit of a, you know, and the Northwest is known for kind of innovation, creativity. And the other person I'll be speaking about today as well, one of our trailblazers, Dr. Mumtaz Patel, is also from Preston. So, you know, it's amazing to hear that. And I think it's really important, especially, you know, I'm a proud Northerner myself. I did my undergraduate in London. And I think that kind of made me more passionate about kind of the North as well. And, you know, my mum's family are from the Northeast. So, you know, you really understand, I think, the dynamics of the North-South divide. And you get to appreciate or understand why that's the case historically. And, you know, kind of why we need to be kind of raising our voices louder in the North to actually, you know, kind of be put on the map or stay on the radar, on the map. I think especially for more marginalised communities as well. You know, there is a lot of politicisation of kind of national issues. And unfortunately, we know that Islamophobia globally is on the increase. So we really need, you know, these positive, contemporary, humanised stories to be made available to everyone And I think the universities, you know, are really well placed to actually disseminate and to inform, you know, the civic spaces through the, you know, the groundbreaking and trailblazing research that's being done, but not necessarily disseminated in the kind of locality. So we are trying harder to engage more with, you know, civic spaces and, you know, kind of more local kind of organisations too, more proactively, I should say, yeah.
Well, the display is called Muslims of the North. It is at Leeds City Museum. It's on for another 12 months, I think, isn't it, Maria?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah,
so yeah, I live in Leeds, so I'm going to go and check it out myself, and I hope you all do too. So Maria Hussein, thank you very much.
Thank you. And just to add, it is free as well, so it's a great day out, you know, for yourself or as a family as well.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Northern Agenda podcast. And don't forget, you can subscribe to our daily newsletter at thenorthernagenda.co.uk. It's more important than ever for Northern voices to be heard. The Northern Agenda is a laudable production for Reach. It's presented by me, Rob Parsons, and it's produced by Daniel J. McLaughlin. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to The Northern Agenda wherever you listen to your podcasts, including Apple and Spotify. Also, check out the other laudable podcasts. See you next week. Bye-bye.